The number one resolution for people last year was to save more money, but nearly half gave up by February. Don't let that be you. Download Rocket Money to reach your financial goals this year. Track your spending, cut waste, and automate savings in one simple app. Rocket Money shows you all your expenses and categorizes them so you know exactly where your money's going and where you're overspending. From there, the app cuts waste by canceling your unused subscriptions and lowering your bills. No customer service needed. With that money freed up, the app will automatically set some cash aside for your goals, whether it's an emergency fund, paying off debt, or saving for vacation. Rocket Money's got you covered. Users love the app with over 186,000 five-star ratings. And on average, users can save up to $740 a year when using all of the app's premium features. Make saving money a priority this year. Go to rocketmoney.com/cancel to get started. That's rocketmoney.com/cancel. rocketmoney.com/cancel.
Planet Fitness has everything you need to start strong, so you can give everything you've got. From plate-loaded strength equipment and functional training areas to treadmills, stair climbers, and free weights. Our equipment is best in class, and our clubs are right around the corner, so you can make this your strongest year yet. Join the club today and save $28 or more when you join for $1 down, $15 a month. Cancel anytime. Deal ends Friday, January 9th. Are you coming? Planet Fitness. We're all strong on this planet. See club for details.
Welcome to Beg to Differ, the Bulwark's weekly roundtable discussion featuring civil conversation across the political spectrum. We range from center-left to center-right. I'm Mona Charon, policy editor at The Bulwark and syndicated columnist, and I'm joined by our regulars, Damon Linker, who writes the Substack newsletter Notes from the Middle Ground, Bill Galston, who writes for The Wall Street Journal and is affiliated with the Brookings Institution, and Linda Chavez of the Niskanen Center. Our special guest this week is Ed Luce, who is the U.S. editor for the Financial Times, as well as a columnist. So welcome one and all. Let's begin with campus unrest. We talked about it last week, but it has escalated since then. We've now had students occupy a building at Columbia University, and police were called in and extricated them. We have had more than 100 campuses around the country have now had protests or encampments about the Gaza-Israel conflict. And at UCLA, we had violence and police called in there as well. Damon, I remember last week, we asked you how things were at Penn. You said they were quiet. And then like within a few hours, you had to email us all and say spoke too soon. So that's what we're dealing with. So I want to begin with our guest, Ed Luce, because Ed, you and I both wrote about this week, a little slightly different emphasis. But you wrote a piece that's been getting a lot of attention where you said the problem isn't the kids, it's the grownups. So why don't you tell us your view of this?
Yeah, I mean, this isn't to say that the kids, and I know they're technically not kids,
right.
Students are adults legally, but it isn't to say that there isn't a tremendous amount of foolishness amongst some of the protesters and obnoxiousness as well. But in terms of the signals we've been getting from the political parties, in terms of the very mixed messaging we've been getting from university administrators. And I think in terms of my own profession, the media in general's tendency to sensationalize, the adults have not been setting a very good example. I mean, I think the most egregious here are the Republicans, but by no means alone in terms of deserving a share of the blame. The sort of breathtaking hypocrisy of people like Senator Tom Cotton and Donald Trump calling for the National Guard to go in to, you know, for trained soldiers to go in and to lock them up, essentially, when they're simultaneously calling for the pardoning of those who've broken and entered into the nation's legislative building to overturn an election is quite remarkable. But I think on the left of the Democratic Party, you've had some really irresponsible rhetoric, sort of backing the more eliminationist wing of the protesters. You've had, finally, I think, very good comments from President Biden today, which is what I think most people would agree with, that we should uphold the right to speech and protect safety. And it's not always easy to do that in practice, but he set out the very clear principle of that. And I hope that more university administrators can follow the lead of places like Chicago and Brown in doing that. There's been some pretty bad university leadership. And again, universities are run by adults.
Linda, a lot of people are concerned that whatever the equities of this issue, the image of disorder and chaos on college campuses is going to play into the hands of the Trumpian right. So your view on that, or anything that you've heard so far?
Well, I had the same feeling in 2020 when Black Lives Matter took to the streets. I thought it was actually going to redound to Donald Trump's benefit and hurt the Democrats. And that certainly did not end up happening. Here, I think that Edward is right in terms of the way that Biden himself has handled the situation. It's also true that it's other Democratic officials who've handled the situation well. We've had Eric Adams in the city of New York sending in the police, and they behaved very professionally. There were not injuries. There was no sense of violence against even the people who were occupying illegally the building there on Columbia. You've seen Gavin Newsom talking out here. The UCLA encampment has been taken apart largely by the California Highway Patrol. And so I'm not so sure that this is going to end up hurting President Biden. There's no question then when you have a scene in which there's chaos and when the demonstrators are from the far left, that's not good for the Democratic Party. And there have been members of Congress, including
Ilhan Omar. Well, let's say what she said. She was asked whether she, you know, condemns the anti-Semitism of some of these protesters. And she said, yes, she's against anti-Semitism, that she thinks Jewish students should be allowed to speak whether they're anti-genocide or pro-genocide. Thanks. Thanks, Representative Omar. That's great.
I mean, it really is unfortunate that this whole debate has centered around the term genocide. One can be critical of the way in which Israel is prosecuting this war, their actions in Gaza, without anywhere coming near to the notion that this is a genocide. There is not a genocide. If they were trying to get rid of the Palestinian people and it was this dictatorial government in Israel, well, the first thing to do, the easiest thing to do, would be round up all the Palestinians who live in Israel proper, who are Israeli citizens. Wouldn't you start there with the easiest people to eliminate if this were a true genocide? Isn't that what Germany did when it was prosecuting its genocide against the Jewish people? So, you know, this is one of the most irritating things. But I, like you, am nervous about how long this stays active. One of the great things is that we are about to go into a summer recess. And so campuses, I don't think, are going to be the focus of as much attention. And as I say, I do believe that Democratic office holders have handled this well by dispensing troops there. And not troops, but police officers there to break up what are these illegal encampments. And so I think that may end up having some positive effect.
Bill, I, like Ed Luce, think that what Biden said was exactly right. You know, he made the point that, you know, everyone has a right in this country to protest and to free speech, et cetera, but you don't have the right to disruption and you don't have the right to close down a campus. But a lot of, I've seen a lot of commentary on the right, on the, you know, not the MAGA right, but the other right, saying that, no, this is a moment where Biden needs to do something much more forceful. He needs to have a sister soldier moment, needs to denounce these left-wing demonstrators. He needs to make clear that he is different from them and that he hasn't been captured by the left. because the people he's losing, and this will kind of bleed into our next segment, but anyway, the people that he is needs to worry about losing from his coalition are not the demonstrators on college campuses, but sort of middle of the road voters, moderates, even conservatives who are Democrats, and therefore he needs to do something more forceful to hold on to them. What do you think?
Well, the most immediate parallel, it seems to me, was the Black Lives Matter demonstrations, if that's the right word for them, in 2020, and how quickly and robustly President Biden distanced himself from and rejected outright calls to defund the police. And I thought that that move was integral to his ability to win in 2020. If he had hesitated or equivocated, I think he could have lost a lot of support very quickly. And I do incline to the view that he could have taken beneficially, politically, a more forceful stand on this issue than he did. And I am absolutely sure that he should have spoken sooner than he did. He waited too long and gave the impression of equivocation and calculation before he finally, you know, took a position which was, on the one hand, correct, but on the other hand, so obvious that he could have said the same thing a week ago or 2 weeks ago. So it's not entirely clear to me how the White House was thinking about this. I mean, he certainly did better than he might have, but I think he could have done better still. Grade B, not A.
Bill, I don't think you've ever given him an A. Let's be honest.
That is really not true. I gave him a string of A pluses when it came to Ukraine and his management of the Western Alliance.
Oh, that's true. That's true. I forgot about that.
In everything I've said or written, I've been a big cheerleader for him. But on many domestic policy issues, I will confess I have some qualms.
Yeah. And that's fine. That's why we love hearing from you. Okay, Damon, you know, these students, so I wrote a piece that came out today, you know, they're kind of a weird combination of Portlandia and Reds. You know, they've got their, you know, their therapy tents and their gluten-free bread and their body oils for sale. And they want to have, you know, food delivered to, from the university food service to the students who are occupying a building at Columbia. They actually asked for that. That's one side of it. But on the other side of it, they are mouthing Hamas talking points, honestly. You know, they are saying things like globalize the intifada. They are specifically intimidating and harassing Jewish students who they call Zionists. Or sometimes they will ask a student, you know, as they did at UCLA, before they could pass through a barricade to get to a library. And the student said, oh, so you're not letting me pass because I'm Jewish? And the protester, masked, by the way, said, no, it's not that you're Jewish. Are you a Zionist? The student said, yes, I am. He said, yeah, we're not letting Zionists through. Okay. So anyway, that is the flavor of some of this. Lesbians against genocide, etc. And yet, despite the unhinged nature of some of these, some of the rhetoric coming out of these demonstrations, the ignorance that it shows about the nature of the conflict and many other things. One of the most revealing aspects of this story is that you've seen professors joining the students or holding up megaphones to say they support what the students are doing. And so some people look at that and they say, you know what? These universities have gone so far off to the left that they're not worth saving. You're at a university.
Well, there's a lot in there. I mean, my general view on these things is to point to the prevalence of the fallacy of composition that is so rampant in our online culture these days, which is you can't generalize from particular cases to the whole, or you do it at great peril to yourselves. And are there some very far left extreme professors at American universities, at elite universities in humanities departments and social science departments? Absolutely, yes. How many? I don't know exactly, but it is by no means a universal thing on a university campus. I mean, you mentioned at the top of the show the amusing fact that last week you asked me how are things at Penn, and I said, oh, there's nothing going on here at all. And then I literally left to go home 20 minutes after we finished recording and got stuck for an hour in gridlock because there was this march of pro-Palestinian protesters coming from Drexel University, which is right adjacent to Penn. And they ended up marching into Penn and parking themselves on the main lawn of the quad. And they've been there ever since with their, you know, green tents like every single place. The interesting question about where all these exactly identical tents are coming from. Is there a common funding source for them? I don't have the answer to that. But, you know, I walked by the protest this afternoon. It was raucous. There's a lot going on. Drums pounding, people with signs, doing protesty things. But, you know, it wasn't that disruptive, and I didn't hear anything offensive. It was just kind of what happens at these events. And so I really don't like when I hear people say, first of all, these protests happening in all these places mean they are all equally extreme and unhinged in their political views. And that then second, that the faculty supports everything that's said there, even the most extreme when the things said are extreme, when in fact the reality is much more complicated. I mean, what percentage of Penn students are taking part in this? I have no idea, but like just by my own untrained eye of crowd, I would say there were a few hundred people there, but there are thousands of undergraduates and a few thousand graduate students at Penn, plus the law school, plus the very large medical school, plus Wharton. Do you think there are a lot of Wharton students in there? Probably not. So I wish people would calm down a little bit in the denunciations. I think campus culture is complicated. It does incline to the left. I don't agree with many of my peers and colleagues here on the substance of you know what these protests are about. I would be happy to debate them on this. I don't feel like I'm being confronted while walking across campus by basically people who are freelance volunteers for Hamas. Some might sound like that, but they're speaking probably in ignorance. They don't know exactly what it is they're saying. They probably haven't read the Hamas charter. They probably, apply undue skepticism to things that you hear about what took place on October 7th. And these are all very kind of common human faults and blind spots. So I, as usual, am trying to be the voice of moderation.
Well, I mean, of course, ignorant people can do tremendous harm. So there is that.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah. A crowd becomes a mob all too easily. Yes.
Okay. Well, Ed, so on the let's all calm down theme, I came of age in the 1970s. So the 60s were just, 10 years previous. And I remember what things were like then. I mean, you didn't just have campus protests. At Cornell, you had armed students taking control of buildings. You had bombings all over the country. And in those days, there was a really potent reason for students to feel that not only were they concerned about an issue, but they had skin in the game. Before they ended the draft, at least, there was the fear of being drafted and being sent to Vietnam. So I think the comparisons to the 60s are probably overdone. But what do you think?
I wouldn't have guessed, Mona, that you came of age in the 70s. I'd have thought far more recently.
Thank you.
I think that the tendency of media and therefore the general public consuming media, following up on what Damon said, to sort of pick up on the more extreme elements in the 60s and today. You know, in the 60s, the Maoists, the pro-Ho Chi Minh, the Black Panthers, and so forth, at the risk of overlooking what I think is not a silent majority, they're pretty noisy, but a mix of people who are probably in it more for humanitarian reasons, don't particularly understand the complexities of the situation on the ground. They might not be able to name the river or the sea if they're chanting that particular slogan, but there is a broader sort of humanitarian impulse here, which I think was the case with the anti-Vietnam War protests and with the Black civil rights protests against Colombia's gentrification that was also going on in the 60s, and with the outsize number of civilian deaths that we're seeing today in Gaza. It's definitely not genocide. I agree with that. But there is disproportionality going on that is consistent with certain war crimes. It would be much, much easier to be more sympathetic if you'd seen protests condemning what happened on October the 7th. I fully share, the sort of bestial, the barbaric nature of what went on then. But I'm inclined to go with Damon a little bit here in saying I suspect that most students who are participating in these various protests are not Hamas ideologues. They probably wouldn't be able to tell you, most of them, the difference between Fatah and Hamas. Queers for Palestine and so forth, and feminists for, is an easy thing to mock, and I have myself. But it's possible to be gay and, have sympathy for, what people are going through in the West Bank as well as Gaza. There's a two-state framing here that I suspect most people, if given a sort of proper conducted exchange of views of what the options are on the table, would go for two-state rather than this eliminationist ideology that gets all the media. So I'm kind of a bit more with Damon on this.
Okay. I wouldn't it be a better world where if universities insisted that people air their views in the form of open forums and debates rather than drum circles and demonstrations and encampments? I mean, that is part of what a university's mission is supposed to be. And universities should say, sorry, that is not how we conduct business here. We're going to have a debate. It's open forum. People can speak respectfully to one another. But these demonstrations are out of bounds. Bill, you wanted to add something?
Two things quickly. Number one, it's not just professors. A number of pretty high up school administrators have also joined in, including the dean of students at Northwestern University just yesterday. Second, I rise to the defense of gluten-free bread. I think you should criticize the students, but leave gluten-free bread out of it.
All right, duly noted. And with that, let us hear from our advertiser, Aura. As much as you want to think your info isn't out there, we can tell you that it is. Data brokers sell your info to scammers and spammers. Your full name with your address, phone number, health records, and relatives are already out there. We hear all the time on the news about a company that has had their system hacked and customer data lost. AT&T revealed that over 73 million customer records, both current and former, were released to the dark web. They recommend that those who are affected use strong passwords, monitor account activity, and consider credit freezes or fraud alerts from credit bureaus. But Aura does all of that for you. They show you which data brokers are selling your info and automatically submit opt-out requests. They also protect you from hackers that try to access your social media, bank accounts, and other sensitive information. If you don't want to use multiple apps just because a company can't keep its data safe, Aura will keep you safe, and it's all with one app. If your info was compromised by the AT&T data breach or one of the many others we hear about, don't worry. Aura is always on and working 24/7. Go to aura.com, that's A-U-R-A.com/beg to differ, to get a 14-day free trial to see how much of your information is being sold. And we thank them for sponsoring this podcast. All right, let's move on to a related topic, which is how the presidential campaign is shaping up. We have the polling, of course, even now, although, you know, we keep saying it's a long time until the election, but of course, the clock is moving. So we're now in May. It is still unbelievably close with the polls within the margin of error. And the Biden campaign, it seems to me, has been responding to its weakness among young voters by taking a couple of steps, and I wonder how you guys would evaluate them. And Linda, I'm going to come to you. One was canceling certain student debt, and the other was changing the classification of marijuana at the federal level. Both, arguably, an attempt to appeal to the youth vote. What do you make of those?
Well, I think they definitely are an attempt to appeal to the youth vote, although there are plenty of people, even in mine and Bill's age bracket, who use marijuana these days. And it is legal in several states, including Colorado, where I lived for some time. I think it's a bad idea. First of all, I think it plays right into the idea, Biden's doing this is a bad idea, it plays right into the idea that the Democrats are the people who try to buy your vote. I have mentioned on the program before my objection to canceling student debt. Why not cancel the debt of people who are, you know, underwater in their mortgages, or cancel the debt of people who are about to have their cars possessed? There is, first of all, a kind of elitist quality in this. There are still only about a third of Americans have college degrees. What about the other two-thirds? And if you wanted to do something in that arena, it would be far better to come up with money to help people go to at least 2 years of college when they graduate high school. And that, I think, is something that you could avail other, particularly people who wanted to go into a trade or something, could avail themselves of that. So I'm not sure it's going to work. On the marijuana issue, I have deep reservations about the legalization of marijuana. It is the marijuana that is being smoked today is smoked and imbibed in various ways, including through brownies and cookies and candies.
Gummies that my dog got in a park.
It's a very different weed than was available when I was in college in the 60s. And Ed, I will accept your saying that I don't look like I could have been in college in the 60s in advance of your having to interject.
I would never have guessed that.
But the truth is, marijuana is a dangerous drug, and what it does, particularly to adolescent brains, is worrisome. So, you know, I just don't necessarily think these are the right moves, and I wish Biden hadn't done it. I think he could have come up with different ways of reaching these particular voters.
Ah, yes, it did sound very pandery. So, Ed, the Harvard Youth Poll came out in the last few days asking 18 to 29-year-olds a number of questions. It asked them to rank 16 issues in ranked order of importance. And, you know, student debt didn't make the list, nor did the Israel-Palestine conflict. That came in 15th out of 16. The issues that were on the top of the list are inflation, healthcare, and housing.
Yeah, look, I think at the margins, the marijuana, I mean, I agree entirely with what Linda's said about the substance, the policy substance of this. The dangers of marijuana, particularly to young minds in formation, are completely underplayed. Yeah. And I happen to know, I mean, I have a close relative who sort of went semi-psychotic for a while. The wake and bake culture at that age is excavating of brains at the very least, and makes you far more vulnerable to depression and stuff. And because of the links between marijuana legalization and the very draconian, ill-conceived and racially skewed three strikes and you're out legislation of the 90s, it's become a progressive issue in which you can't sort of raise these downsides. So I strongly agree with Linda on that point, and also about the fiscally regressive element of student debt forgiveness, even though it's sort of limited to people with incomes of $125,000 and below. The major issue, unfortunately, for young, middle, and old for this election is not going to be the future of the Republic or the quality or the health of American democracy. That is an elite concern. It shouldn't be. Democracy is by definition about the rule of by the people. But these issues are generally ones that we who are in sort of the fields, various fields we're in, know about and care more about than the median voter. That's just a plain fact of life. That was always true of every democracy ever. And so I hope the Biden campaign, I think I see evidence of the Biden campaign adjusting to that and focusing on very specific issues like women's right to choose, like $35, insulin caps, stuff that has real, tangible, beneficial effects for many, many voters. And I'm seeing some evidence they're doing more of that. But the single biggest thing that Biden could have that would help his re-election is something that's out of his control. And that's what Jay Powell and his board at the Fed do with interest rates. You know, inflation, when you ask people about inflation, they tend to think in different ways to economists. Right. They include interest rates as their idea of inflation. And of course, inflation, interest rates are not technically included in the consumer price index. But if you're paying 8% on a mortgage and on your auto loan and in your credit card debt, that's inflation compared to 2%. So the single biggest thing that could happen to Biden, if you look at voter priorities, is something he can't control, which is interest rate cuts.
Damon, I'm not 100% sure that democracy won't be a salient issue come November. Not 100%, because I do think that if the Biden administration, the Biden campaign rather, does this correctly, they will elevate the issue and make people aware of just how dangerous and crazy a second Trump term would be, and that fear, as the old saying goes, will do the work of reason when it comes to those issues in November. But I wonder if we can focus for a minute on Biden's seeming desire. This is what I worry about in him as a candidate, is that he still seems stuck in this idea of wanting to sort of grab the electorate by the lapels and shake them and say, look at all the great things I've done for you. And I just don't think that's a sale. I think people feel that prices are too high, as Ed was saying, and we've said on other shows, and they don't think Biden's done a great job. But if Biden can then shift the emphasis away from, please approve of everything I've done and appreciate everything I've done, to the other guy is way worse, and that's your choice, sorry, that's the path for him. It has to be about Trump. What do you think?
Well, he is in a bad bind. I mean, at a kind of the deepest structural level, I mean, we don't have enough data on it yet because we've only been through a few electoral cycles since this phenomenon really got underway of negative partisanship. But since Bush, the second Bush, who improved his standing between 2000 and 2004, we have Obama, who did win re-election, but with a lot softer number than he won it the last time. Then we have Trump, who loses his bid for re-election. And now Biden, I'm sorry, I'm going to come out and say it. He is losing. It is not just that it's close. It's close, and Biden is consistently behind by little. Now, it's close enough that this could turn around maybe in the last month. There'll be a shift in momentum, and it'll just be, 2 points or 2.5 points up for Biden and down for Trump, and that'll make the difference. And Biden will sort of, as it were, limp across the finish line and actually prevail. So, 6 months is a long time. But if you look at his approval ratings, if you look at the head-to-head polls, it is consistent, painfully sloggingly consistent that they are within the margin of error, but with Trump slightly ahead in the head-to-head and Biden consistently below 40%, except for a day or two here or there. Those are bad numbers. And if it is the case that actually at the level of a nationwide election, because of negative partisanship, what you end up with is, and polarization, what you end up with is that actually presidents no longer enjoy an incumbency advantage. They actually have an incumbency disadvantage, that you basically come in, you have a little honeymoon. If you're Trump, it's like 2 weeks long. If you're Biden, it's about 6 months long. And then you go underwater and you never recover. And you have to fight for every millimeter to try to just barely get reelected. If that's the dynamic, then it's not entirely clear how you campaign other than by contributing to the negativity, by saying, yeah, you don't like me, but the other person is just worse in every single possible way. And so, I mean, I agree with you in asking about whether Biden is making a mistake and continually trying to say, look how great I've been doing. I agree that I don't think, I mean, we've lived through it. You have your opinion about it right now. You either think things have been good under Biden and better than they were under Trump, or you don't. And yeah, I don't think it's very effective to try to make the case that actually you're wrong. It's actually better than you're sure that it is. And so he seems stuck on that. And that's why I think, regardless of the substantive reason for thinking that we should maybe emphasize the threat to democracy, because Trump is, in fact, an enormous threat to democracy, there's a kind of dynamic to the campaign that will inevitably lead the Biden camp to have to go to an anti-Trump message. And, you know, Trump, thankfully, keeps giving lots of ammunition for that. Boy, what an article in Time magazine this week, huh? Like whole paragraphs of that. You could just cut it out and put it there up on the screen and have an ominous voice read it verbatim about what he says he's going to do. And you would think that Trump would be 20 points behind. And yet,
except that hasn't happened yet.
Exactly.
But it's going to. I mean, those ads are coming.
Yeah.
And those text messages and emails and social media posts, it's all coming. Hasn't happened yet.
We'll see. Well, I'm watching those polls. I'm waiting.
Yeah,
is it going to turn around? When is Biden going to go up?
Now, admittedly, you cited Obama, and it's true that he was reelected with a lower margin than he was elected with. But he was still reelected very comfortably, and he was reelected against somebody that was not crazy, who was a perfectly reasonable candidate. I thought he was great. I thought he would have been a good president, Mitt Romney. The last two presidents have been exceedingly unpopular. I'm not sure that the incumbency thing is completely gone, but we'll see about that. I mean, the time will tell. So, Bill, respond to anything you've heard. You wrote a long piece about this, which was excellent at the Brookings Institution. But then I would like to press you a little bit on immigration, because some of the data that we got from that Harvard poll on that subject were interesting, too. Maybe immigration not quite as harmful, certainly among young people, to Biden as other things.
Well, young people are going to be a small section of the electorate. I can tell you that for the electorate as a whole, Biden is less trusted than Trump to deal with immigration by a margin of 20 percentage points. It is not an issue, I think, that the Biden campaign wants to dwell on. As a matter of fact, every day that it's off the front pages is a good day for the Biden campaign.
Yeah.
With regard to where the race now is, you know, I would go in Damon's direction, but farther. 2 points will have to suffice. If you get me started on the piece I just published, I'll go on for an hour, and there's clearly not time for that. Number one, Biden won the national popular vote by 4.5 percentage points last time, and it was just barely enough, as we know. A shift of 43,000 votes in the three narrowest states would have yielded a 269 to 269 tie in the Electoral College and utter chaos, even more than we saw in 2020.
Bill, sorry to interrupt, but can you just say a word about the structural advantage that the Republicans have in the Electoral College vis-a-vis? So Biden has to win by 3 or 4 percentage points in order to win the Electoral College because of the structural right. nature of it. There are more states that are that are Republican than Democrat.
Well,
right?
That's true, but the real problem is that there are a handful of Democratic states, large states, that generate millions of so-called wasted votes.
Mm-hmm.
And if you compare the top 5 blue states to the top 5 red states, for example, by size, you know, there's an excess in wasted votes of something like 5 million mm-hmm. to the Democrats' disfavor. I'll go back and do the math on that. I haven't done it since 2020. But
the point is that you know, he'll get millions more votes, but the Democrat will right. get millions more votes in California than he will get in Wyoming, and it doesn't matter. They each get the same number. I mean, they don't get the same number, but the Electoral College votes in Wyoming right. count way more than the ones in California.
I mean, I could drop all sorts of scholarly caveats here, but I won't. Okay. But he needed most of that 4.5 percentage point national vote edge. Right now, he's behind in the national popular vote by 1.5%, which means that he is in a 6-point hole relative to where he needs to be.
But is that true in the swing states?
I did a swing state analysis, you know, in my piece. Biden won 6 of the 7 swing states in 2020. He is behind in all 7 now. All 7. And in the 2 southern states and southwestern states, he is behind by margins that are actually worse than in the national popular vote, substantially worse. So there's a huge split right now, and I think this will have consequences for the campaign down the road, between the way he's doing in the southern states of North Carolina, Georgia, the southwestern states of Arizona and Nevada on the one hand, and the so-called blue wall states of the Midwest on the other. So my analysis, stripped to its essentials, is that if Biden wins the 3 blue wall states, he will be the next, he will have a second term. If he loses any one of them, I think Trump will win the election. I think it's almost as simple as that. And the possible caveat to that is that if the abortion issue has a huge impact on the outcome in Arizona, that could shift the calculus. But Arizona is not as big a state as Michigan or Pennsylvania, right? So it's not a full substitute. If you lose Michigan or Pennsylvania, you need to get both Nevada and Arizona to make up for it. But I'm getting down into the weeds.
No, we like weeds.
But this is the way the election is going to be won or lost. One other point, and that is, I was really struck in looking at the swing states by how powerful the economic issue is. Just, you know, one datum will do. You know, a massive poll of the swing states commissioned by Bloomberg and done by Morning Consult, one of the questions gave respondents 15 different economic indicators, ranging from traditional Democratic indicators such as unemployment and wages to traditional Republican indicators such as taxes and spending. When the dust settled and the responses were counted, the 5 indicators dealing with prices in one area or another, including interest rates, Ed, I know with interest that the guy you used to work for, he co-authored an article about a month ago arguing, I think very conclusively, that interest rates were part of the overall inflation calculus and that people experienced them that way. So you're absolutely right about that. But all 5 of the indicators that came out on top had to do with prices in these swing states. And there's no way of getting around that. And, you know, and so if people say prices are too high and your riposte is, well, the unemployment rate is low, that's not an argument that is cutting any political ice right now.
No. And it would.
And the Biden administration seemed to me quite slow to pick up on that. And I'm with Ed. I don't see what they say about prices right now, but there's an interesting, and this will be my last little point. Biden, when you looked at these five price indicators, Biden was actually more trusted than Trump on one of them, namely healthcare prices.
Healthcare.
Right? Because he had a list of specifics that he could point to that meant something to people. But when it came to housing, what does he have to say?
Mm-hmm.
So, and the other four, the others on that list, the same. So it is, as Brits used to say, maybe still do, a real sticky wicket for Biden.
Okay, Ed, I'm going to play devil's advocate here and say that many, many American voters, you might have even mentioned this in your piece this week, many, many American voters do not focus on the choice they are facing at this stage, this far away from an election. And when you ask them how they're feeling, they're going to be very hard on the sitting president, because Americans always hold the president responsible for their economic health. And so they may say, well, yeah, I'm furious and I hold Biden responsible for these high prices for food and clothing and housing and everything else, car loans, et cetera. But when they are faced with a choice, it becomes a little different. And then they have to recognize, as Biden likes to say, don't compare me to the almighty, compare me to the alternative. And so, you know, maybe the Biden team needs to hire somebody to write a really catchy jingle that points out that tariffs are taxes, you know, tariffs are taxes, and then, you know, play that again and again, because Trump has promised, and I doubt very much he will back away from this, he's promised to impose an across-the-board 10% tariff, which means everybody's taxes go up by 10%. Everybody's. The poor, middle class, everybody's taxes go up. And so that would possibly begin to have a conversation about not just that prices are too high, but that they might go higher if the voters chose Trump. What do you think?
I think that's something inevitably that's going to start happening. I mean, Trump would be inflationary on a number of levels, not just these 10% tariffs and up to 100%, by the way, on car imports. But in terms of his threat to the independence of the Fed, he's vowed he would fire Jay Powell. He might not succeed in firing Jay Powell. I mean, it's quite hard to do because he's got a statutory term there. But it expires a year after Trump would take office. And the very thought that Art Laffer or, you know, Stephen Moore or somebody like that would become the next chair, or another sort of magical thinker would become the next Fed chair, and that its independence, that Trump was pushing Congress to end its independence, that would put a massive risk premium on U.S. Treasury bonds. This would add to the cost of living in many different ways. And then, of course, expelling 10 or more million people, as he vows to do, you know, that's inflation.
Absolutely.
When you kick out tons of people from the labor market. So the extent to which Biden can reorient the conversation towards what the impact of Trump would be, the better, in very practical, clear terms. You know, I've been in America almost 20 years, and I've never come across an election, even 2016 and 2020, that compares to our inability to see beyond November the 5th. Yeah. We are rightly so existential about this election. We're not focusing on what Biden would do on a second term, in his second term, and he isn't either. And he's going to be, I think. The I like Ike, you know, tariffs are bad kind of ditty that he needs to get out there. Very bumper sticker friendly, you know, very intuitive and easy to understand. I suspect must be in the pipeline because this is so obvious. And in answer to Bill, we still say sticky wicket. And Biden is on a sticky wicket.
All right. We'll move on now to our final segment, which is a highlight or lowlight of the week. And we'll start with our guest, Ed Luce.
Highlight was perhaps I'm being a bit too mischievous here, but highlight was colleague of mine asked a question to this student spokesman outside Hamilton Hall in Columbia this week, my colleague Josh Chaffin, about how they were getting food and water. And she was demanding that, you know, essentially catering from the administration. You know, I just thought that was such a wonderful illustration of perhaps the less kind stereotypes about her generation being a fairly soft generation. David Frum had a wonderful tweet, which is, the revolution will not be catered. That was my highlight. I have to think of a low light. I apologize.
No, that's all right. Thank you for that. Linda Chavez.
Well, I have a low light, and it has to do with Marjorie Taylor Greene and her statement on Twitter for why she voted against the bill condemning anti-Semitism, and actually incorporating anti-Semitism is one of the things you can't do and receive federal aid. She said, anti-Semitism is wrong, but I will not be voting for the Anti-Semitism Awareness Act of 2023 today that could convict Christians of anti-Semitism for believing the gospel that Jesus was handed over to Herod to be crucified by the Jews. Where do I begin with this? I don't know what Bible she was reading, but I can tell you that that scenario does not play out in Matthew, Mark, Luke, or John. Maybe in the Bible of Trump. I haven't seen that new version. But in fact, Jews did not crucify Jesus, in part because Jews were not able to crucify anyone in Judea at the time. It was the Romans who were in control, and they are the ones who, in fact, it was Pontius Pilate who eventually condemned Jesus to be crucified, which was a uniquely Roman punishment. Rome crucified people all over the world when it controlled major parts of the world. It was so disgusting. It was such a both ahistorical. And she clearly, I'm sure she considers herself a faithful Christian, she clearly doesn't know her Bible well. So she is my low light of the week.
She's a sinister fool.
She is a fool.
Yeah. Okay. Bill Galston.
My low light is very simple. About 17 minutes before Tony Blinken landed at Ben Gurion Airport, Netanyahu issued a statement saying that Israel was going into Rafah, agreement or no agreement, quote unquote. It was a deliberate effort to sabotage American diplomacy and to embarrass the U.S. Secretary of State. Unacceptable.
Thank you. Damon Linker.
Well, in the interest of trying to go light, because, you know, I got to do that, got to pace myself with this election. There's a lot of news, and it's not all of it very good. I'm going to suggest that listeners enjoy a two-part documentary about comedian Steve Martin that is on Apple TV. It is really delightful. And I loved Steve Martin as a kid. I was quite young in the 70s and early 80s when he was at his stand-up heyday, most prominent in the culture. But his two albums that were very big at the time were kind of mainstays in my household. And I laughed silly listening to them. And my brother and I to this day make little Steve Martin jokes based on those two records. And actually, that kind of the first half of the documentary covers that early period of his youth through his massive explosion in that period as a stand-up. But then the second half, I didn't expect to be as gripping because I sort of, you know, he hasn't been as much on my radar since. But I, first of all, was reminded by that second documentary of how many really light, delightful films he made and was in throughout the 80s and 90s. And then aside from that, he's just a really interesting, deep guy who has lots of very interesting and deep things to say about all kinds of things in his life and the world and his career. And I remained quite interested in it and entertained by it all the way through. So if you're looking at looking for a really fun documentary to watch, I recommend this. Again, it's on Apple TV. And I forget, it's a documentary in two pieces, I think, is what it's called. And they are different in tone and style, too. So it's an interesting combination, but definitely worth watching.
Excellent. I've jotted it down.
Excellent.
So I would also like to recommend something on TV. So we are planning a little trip at the end of this month down to Nashville, where I've never visited before. And of course, Nashville is the capital of country music. And I'm not particularly a country music fan. My tastes tend to run more to classical music. But since we're going to be in Nashville, we were told that we had to watch this series that Ken Burns produced called Country Music. And I have to say, it's been, so far we've watched, I think, two episodes, and it is a whole area of American history that is somewhat new to me. And it's opening my eyes to a lot of things. It's also the origin of a lot of songs that are, of course, in my head, but I didn't really know where they came from. And so it's been very, very enjoyable and eye-opening. And it's available on, I don't know, it's probably on YouTube and various other places, maybe Netflix. I'm not sure what platform we're watching it on, but I recommend it. Even if you're not a country music fan, you'll learn a lot about this country. That's always useful. All right. I want to thank our guest, Ed Luce, who had to run off because he had to go pick up his dad at the airport. So we thank him for joining us. And of course, all of my regulars. I want to thank our producer, Jim Swift, and our sound engineer, Jonathan Siri. And of course, our wonderful viewers and listeners. And Beg to Differ will return next week, as every week.